Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Will Arimus. Hey everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, January 22nd.
On today's show, we'll talk about news that the French government has fined Google around $57 million for violating the new European privacy laws that went into effect last year. This comes as news that the Federal Trade Commission here in the United States is considering levying a record-breaking fine against Facebook for violations to their users' privacy following the Cambridge Analytica mess. And corporate fines may well be a theme this year following the great cleanup after the 2016 election went awry.
And then we're going to talk about Juul. Not the Alaskan folk singer, but the multi-billion dollar e-cigarette company that's dominating that new industry. It's been quite a year for Juul. Their offices were raided by the FDA. They at least provisionally agreed to stop selling certain fruity flavors of tobacco, clearly popular with kids. They accepted a $13 billion investment from Altria, the parent company of Marlboro. And most recently, this month, they announced a new $10 million national TV marketing campaign to help make sense of the company that controls an estimated 70% of the e-cigarette market and the vaping trend in general. We'll be joined by Natasha Tiku, senior writer for Wired, who's been covering the company.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we saw on the web this week. That's all coming up on If Then.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, Will, how's it going?
It's all right. Thanks. It's bitterly cold here on the East Coast, and my cat is in the hospital at the moment with some kind of stomach issue. He probably ate some cord or cable that he wasn't supposed to. So hopefully that turns out all right. Other than that, I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm probably doing better than your cat. Is a cat hospital the same as the cat doctor? Is that like the same thing?
No, the cat hospital is like it's a whole nother level. Yeah, it's the animal hospital.
Wow, I did not know that.
We carted him meowing in there today, and hopefully everything comes out all right. He was in the habit of chewing on my Mac laptop cables for a long time, the power cords. Those things are like $80 each, so I've probably spent $500 lifetime on Mac power cables. But this time it's come back to haunt him.
That's really weird that cats chew on those out of all of the hard objects in the world they could chew on. But, you know, something that I've been chewing on, to make an awkward transition, are the fines that will ostensibly be levied on companies throughout this year as we reckon with both the new European set of privacy laws that are very strict and apparently hard to follow, as well as the kind of aftermath of the public referendum that Facebook and Google and Twitter and social media companies have gone through after the 2016 election.
I'm still stuck on that segue from chewing on cables to chewing
on
the fines.
Sorry, I don't know.
But no, this is serious. This is serious. So, but tell me, the French government fined Google close to $57 million for violating GDPR. That's that huge suite of privacy laws that Europe passed. What exactly did Google do to deserve this? And $57 million sounds like a lot for almost anybody except Google, but for Google, it's probably a drop in the bucket, right?
So basically, from what I can tell, the regulator says that there was a lack of transparency around the way information was shared or the way like users' information is shared. People were not informed about how data was collected, particularly when it comes to personalized advertising. And the second part of your question, which is, you know, is this fine substantive or is this going to really hit their like pocketbook enough to change their behavior, is a really, really good one, right? Because we're talking about companies that make well over $100 million a day, right? I mean, I don't know about Google for sure, but I just wrote a story about Facebook looking at their SEC filings and they, you know, brought in over $40 billion in revenue in 2017. That's over $109 million a day. You know, $57 million is like, you know, a few hours of work, right?
So, yeah, Google is earning, I believe, about $35 billion per quarter.
Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about like, you know, a bathroom break or a coffee break or something. Like, this is just not something that is really going to make the company flinch in terms of a penalty. If the idea of the penalty is to change behavior, right? If that's the purpose.
Right. I guess there's the question of do the financial penalties continue and escalate if they don't fix things about their products? And then how hard are those to fix? I mean, does Google just have to add a couple extra lines of disclosure here and there? Or does this force them to somehow fundamentally change the way they collect data on people?
Yeah.
And I think that'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
It's not just whether or not the fines escalate. You know, another piece of news that came out at the end of last week is that the Federal Trade Commission is considering, you know, what it would fine potentially Facebook if Facebook is found to have violated their 2011 consent decree, which required that the company get explicit permission from users before sharing data, which it appears the company might not have done, as we learned with Cambridge Analytica. And the way that data was shared, you know, and that fine could exceed the $22.5 million that Google was fined last year for breaking a privacy agreement with the commission. And, you know, I think I was talking to various experts about this at the end of last week, Jennifer Taub from Vermont Law School. And, you know, she had a really interesting take. She was saying that it's not about the size of the fine when we're talking about a company this big. It's about who pays the fine, right? And so, you know, if this is just going to be absorbed by the company or the shareholders, then those who made the bad decisions to operate the company in a way that was harming users and harming the company won't necessarily be, you know, inspired to change their behavior because they're not really being hit by this at all. She says that a better way to go about this, and I spoke to other experts too who echoed this, would be to actually fine the executives and for the regulators to pinpoint, you know, where the money is coming from, right? Not so that it's not coming from the shareholders, but that, you know, it's coming from actually the executives who had to make the decision. And this is something that the SEC has done a bit. I don't think the FTC has done it, but it's really important to think about the shape of these fines and not just about the amount, right? And kind of like what kind of fine it is and who has to pay it. You know, looking at the SEC filing, just to ramble a bit more of Sheryl Sandberg, for example, you know, Facebook's proxy statement from 2017, you know, she brought in, I think, over $25 million last, you know, that year. That's a ton of money.
In salary, right?
No, not just in salary, in compensation, in stock, everything. Yeah. But I mean, they're making a ton of money and the executives are not going to have to absorb that. And so, you know, perhaps they won't change their behavior. And, you know, there is a world where Facebook might be perfectly happy paying $20 million a year every year. To continue their porous privacy practices, which is obviously making the company a ton of money. They continue to, you know, exceed, you know, their profits every year.
That's an interesting point. And it would be entertaining to see the finger pointing that goes on or who gets thrown under the bus at the companies as they try to figure out who's responsible exactly.
If the executives have to pay or the board has to pay, which is comprised of Facebook executives, you know, in this case.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. The other thing I was thinking is, I don't know if this will really make a difference, but just the fact that they are getting fined. I mean, Facebook has been accused of violating that FTC consent decree over and over and over again. But if they actually get fined, even if it doesn't hurt them financially, it's now on the record that they violated it. You know, that they promised the American people they were going to do this and that to protect their privacy, and then they did not do it, and they were sort of found guilty. I mean, it's not a criminal court, obviously, but in a sense, they were found guilty of wrongdoing, and that should be some kind of disincentive for them to keep breaking these rules.
I don't know if a bad news cycle is going to dissuade Facebook from doing anything. They seem to weather a lot of bad news cycles and just keep on keeping on. I think that the threat of policy, you know, and actual regulation would. And so, you know, maybe having a definitive verdict on this would inspire lawmakers to do something.
That's a good point.
But I'm not sure. Facebook has been really good at apologizing for 14 years now, as I Tufekci pointed out in her fantastic Wired piece last year.
Yeah, that's a good point. And maybe for lawmakers who are on the fence, or they sat at these hearings and listened to Mark Zuckerberg talk and confuse the issue, and they just came away thinking, well, I don't really know if they did anything wrong or not. Maybe seeing these companies get fined gives them the sort of cover or the sort of assurance that, yes, there is something shady going on here. There is something wrong. And then they look at the amount of the fines and think, well, maybe we need policy here and not just not just slaps on the wrist.
Yeah, last thing I'll say is that, like, Facebook actually did something really bad here. They had a rule that they were supposed to follow. Like, the whole point of creating federal policy is that it's followed, right? When they explicitly don't follow it for years, you know, that's a big deal. And this is grounds for, I think, you know, thinking about, you know, who pays this fine for policy change. This is not like a minor infraction that lasted a short amount of time either. They did this for years. So we'll see how it plays out for sure. And I'm happy to see that you're opening with this conversation, actually.
Just one more thing I wanted to put in there is that Facebook's consent decree with the FTC, for people who don't know, this was something they had to agree to as part of a settlement back in 2011 for already screwing people over. Like, they were you know, allegedly misleading their users in all sorts of ways about how their information would be used. So then the deal was, the FTC said, look, all right, you have to promise to to notify people every time you change how you use their data. You have to promise XYZ, and that's the promises that Facebook went ahead and broke.
We're going to keep following this for sure, but we're actually going to pivot to another Facebook company, because this company is so inescapable, and that is WhatsApp. Made some major changes, I think, yesterday or earlier this week they announced that. What exactly is happening with WhatsApp, Will?
Right. So WhatsApp, the messaging app that Facebook acquired several years ago and that has become a dominant messaging app in many parts of the world, although not in the United States, has decided that it will limit the number of people that you can forward a message to five people or groups. You can forward something to five individuals or groups, but you can't forward it to more than that. And that might sound like a small thing. It was initially put into practice in India by Facebook last year, by WhatsApp. That was WhatsApp's largest market. Now it's going to be rolled out globally, but it's actually something that critics had been calling for.
By limiting the way things spread, Facebook is hoping to, you know, stop false information from going super viral, and trying to keep this app a really local chat app, as opposed to this kind of chat app that just ripples into a global network. Now, you know, limiting things to five people doesn't mean that, you know, five people and five people and five people and five people and five people can't quickly cascade to many more. But it sure does reduce the broadcasting power of those who have, you know, nefarious intent or are trying to stir hatred, and puts a lot more work on them to seed those rumors and to push them out. You know, one thing I'm curious about, though, are bot accounts or different ways that people who are expert at planting viral misinformation will find ways to dance around this. I also am curious why they decided to roll this out kind of worldwide, like what findings they had about, you know, this being a real limiting force for stopping the spread of misinformation, or if it's not about misinformation. Why did they say they're doing this because of specifically misinformation, Will?
Yes. They said, we settled on five as the limit because we believe this is a reasonable number to reach close friends while helping prevent abuse. And in fact, this was called for by a group of academics last year ahead of the Brazilian elections.
Right,
again, because
that.
The idea was, this is a closed network. This is private communication, but people were able to just instantaneously pass on rumors or memes or conspiracy theories or incitements to violence to huge groups of people all at once. And so, you know, fake news was flourishing perhaps even more on WhatsApp than it did on platforms like Facebook, where at least the outside world can kind of see what's being shared and what's going on.
Yeah, I'm curious how this will play out. This is a proposal that academics who have thought long and hard about this, forwarded last year, and it makes a lot of sense to me. It's limiting the broadcast power of individuals. And, you know, WhatsApp is a very unique platform. So also something that I look forward to watching, particularly when big news moments swell, or, you know, if we see another instance of like a dictatorial government trying to use the platform to forward hate, or just hate groups using the platform around the world. So yeah, definitely an interesting development, and perhaps overdue, but welcome.
All right, with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have our interview with Wired's Natasha Tiku about Juul and the e-cigarette industry.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Our guest today is Natasha Tiku, senior writer for Wired, covering Silicon Valley, technology, and culture. Natasha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with the basics. And I know this is going to sound extremely obvious to anybody in their 20s or probably their late teens, but for those of us who are old and untrendy and grew up with cigarettes instead of vape pens, can you just tell us what is Juul and why are people juuling instead of smoking?
Sure. So Juul is an e-cigarette and it is wildly popular among kids and also among vapers. It looks like a kind of a thin rectangle, like an extended USB port, and it comes with different pods in flavors like mango, cucumber, mint. And part of the reason that it's so ubiquitous, you know, once I talk to you about it, you'll start seeing that everyone's kind of secretly puffing on a Juul as they walk down the street, is because it's really discreet. And that's initially how the company tried to market it. Like, here is the Apple of e-cigs. You know, it'll give you the same buzz, we promise. It has very high nicotine content. And, you know, you can do it anywhere.
And so it's become really popular with kids. Is it legal to buy if you're under 18? Is that why it's surged in popularity with teens?
It is. So the FDA has begun a crackdown that makes it much harder to obtain. But for a while there, it was fairly easy to buy it online. If you start looking around your friendly neighborhood bodega, you'll see that it was, it's always stocked on the shelves in 7-Elevens and other kinds of retail stores. Actually, Juul has 70% of the retail market. And considering that the company just launched in 2015, that's incredible growth.
Right. And so there's like a fear that it has nicotine in it, that it's getting kids addicted. It is getting kids addicted, is it? Or that this is kind of a gateway to smoking cigarettes, right? That's kind of part of the concern here.
Yeah, that's definitely part of the concern. I mean, the FDA, the CDC has talked recently about an epidemic, and they don't use that term lightly, of e-cigarette use among youth. They feel like it's set back decades of gains made by anti-tobacco public health advocates. Part of the reason why it's so popular among kids is because the company's profile grew through social media, through like viral posts on Instagram and YouTube. And part of the reason why Juul was able to stay under the radar for a bit is that these posts were being done by influencers. So the company wasn't necessarily paying for it, and adults weren't necessarily seeing, you know, the videos on YouTube or the posts on Instagram.
What are the health effects of Juul? I mean, we know it's supposed to be better for you than smoking cigarettes, right? Because it doesn't have the additives that are linked with lung cancer, but it's still obviously a nicotine product.
Right. Well, the FDA has yet to go through its licensing, you know, the equivalent of a licensing product for e-cigarettes. So a lot of it is unknown. Juul's kind of growth at all costs strategy towards pushing its product around is based on the idea that, you know, the problem is combustible cigarettes, and that its product, which uses nicotine salts, it will end up saving people's lives. But we've already seen, based on some early studies, you know, nothing is definitive yet, that kids are seeming to increase their use exponentially after they start trying it, and also that Juul's particular pods are very high in nicotine, and you know, potentially even higher than what they say. I mean, just on the way into work this morning, I saw a bus stop in Oakland that said, you know, just so you know, one Juul pod is equivalent to one pack of cigarettes. And I would wager that most of the kids smoking it, and even some of the adults, or most of the adults, don't know that. And that's something that, you know, your question about its Juul's intentions, you know, if it was always on the up and up and really health oriented, I think they would have made that clear. There's been a number of lawsuits filed by parents who say that Juul addicted their kids to nicotine, and they say that kids didn't even know that it contained nicotine. I mean, when you hit it, it's very mild seeming. You know, it'll definitely give you a buzz, but I could see how somebody might not even know what was in it.
Yeah, I've heard that for a lot of young people these days, like, smoking is totally uncool, but Juuling or vaping has become really trendy in the way that smoking maybe used to be in an earlier generation. But Juul has been forced by the FDA to change its whole marketing scheme. And so now I went to their website earlier today, and they're marketing themselves exclusively as a healthier option for existing smokers, right? They're saying they're targeting the world of a billion adult smokers and trying to get them to switch to something safer. I even heard somebody describe them, or maybe they describe themselves as a health tech company, which seems like a little bit of a stretch, but there is this equation about, like, are they saving more lives of existing smokers because Juul is healthier than conventional cigarettes, or are they going to end up costing more lives because they get a whole new generation addicted to nicotine just at a time when cigarettes were becoming less and less popular?
Right. Well, I think it's important. There's one big caveat on the recent FDA crackdown, which has been very intense. I mean, they raided Juul's office to get documents. They've been putting out a lot of proposed regulations, but these are all proposed for now. And the FDA is working with Juul and with other tobacco companies on a kind of, you know, what kinds of regulatory changes will suffice. And the closer you look, you know, it comes with a lot of asterisks. Like, they've taken out the mango, cucumber, and other flavors that estimate about, like, 55% of its sales. However, they say that if retail stores start complying, they can bring it back. And, you know, even though they took out mango, they're keeping mint pods in the store. And the public health advocates I've talked to say, you know, there are no mint cigarettes. Why would you need this if it's for smoking cessation or switching?
Yeah, one thing that just feels so disingenuous to me, I mean, just, you know, remembering being a kid and smoking a lot of marijuana, and then after that, moving to smoke cigarettes. And it's not like marijuana, you know, has something in it that, like, makes you want to smoke cigarettes. It's just you get used to smoking. It's culture. You know what I mean? It's like, it's something that you kind of get used to doing with your hands. You know, maybe smartphones have replaced cigarettes for some people in many ways. But it seems like with so much of the social media campaigns that they had, and now, you know, these television commercials and stuff, that they really are trying to create kind of a culture of coolness around this. And it seems like the culture is what kind of drives kids to smoke more. And so, I don't know, it just seems like the whole product is based on, you know, smoking in some form or another being cool, and that's always going to lead to health risks. So, I don't know, it just always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, the whole, like, Juul premise.
Right. Well, I think there are serious questions about what Juul's initial intentions are. I mean,
sure,
the aura of cool around Juul, there is a strong argument to be made that it was unintentional. You know, a lot of the even academics who studied the viral growth on social media, they say a lot of those posts are not paid for. And the recent TV commercial that you mentioned, you know, that all shows adult smokers who switched, who are over 35 or something, and, you know, it's in really drab browns, and, you know, it looks like an anti-tobacco ad. However, you know, this is happening in 2019 after Juul has already benefited from the viral growth of its social media campaign. So, you know, if you were, say it was completely unintentional, and you were a company that was doing this, how would you behave? I think based on its response, it doesn't seem like Juul has changed its mind about, you know, its growth at all costs strategy. For example, the company took a $12.8 billion investment from Altria,
right,
the maker of Marlboro, for 35% stake in the company that values it at $38 billion. Now, you know,
that's a lot of money.
Now they're sharing interest with Marlboro.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, you're going to have to sell a lot more e-cigs in order to, you know, make good on that $38 billion valuation. And part of what they said is that they're going to benefit from Marlboro's, you know, obviously their lobbying, but also their distribution and logistics. Marlboro said they might, you know, start putting Juul ads in its cigarette packs. You know, and they have dominant shelf space behind the counter. And public health advocates are worried that rather than, you know, so do you trust Altria to be committed to wanting to make its products obsolete? Otherwise, what you're doing is setting it up for people to be using both and for smoking cessation to get even harder because you can kind of use Juul surreptitiously, you know, while you're at work or, you know, in areas where you can't smoke.
So in some ways, this is such a Silicon Valley company. I mean, it came from Stanford design students, I think. It's based in San Francisco. If you look at their marketing, it's like it's all tech company marketing. It's like we're on a mission to improve the lives of a billion adult smokers. And our products have a unique satisfaction profile and a simple interface. But on the other hand, this is sort of like, to me, I wonder if we're in a new era of Silicon Valley in terms of where startups are going. I mean, we had the big social media booms and the internet companies, and then we had Uber and Netflix, and then the Uber of everything, right? Like you take every kind of service and you make it accessible via an app on demand. But now you've got companies like Juul and then the scooter companies. I don't know, maybe this is a stretch, but you're somebody who's covered Silicon Valley and the startup scene for a long time. What do you make of some of the hottest startups now being about sort of real world physical products that don't really have anything to do with the internet?
I mean, I find it quite terrifying because our ability to oversee and regulate these things is, you know, can't keep up with the growth rate of a really well-funded startup, you know, these companies, you know, you could liken it also to WeWork. These companies are getting valuations based on tech companies, which grow by just multiplying their, you know, use of software. When you're talking about human beings who are going to start smoking Juul, you know, take everything you've ever heard about Facebook in terms of addiction or social media in terms of addiction and, you know, add the highest stakes possible, your life. And I find it really, you know, I talked to the company kind of in the midst of this backlash against them, and they really sound like, you know, they sound like any other startup you two have probably interviewed, and they also seem to believe, at least for a while, that the fix came from technology as well. Like one of their proposed solutions for dealing with Juul use in schools was a Bluetooth device that shut the Juuls down, you know, while you were on school property. And you know, the implication, if it worked, the implications of tracking kids who are using your product. It's staggering. So I find this alarming on many levels. But at the same time, I will say, I mean, and this is, I think, what makes it tricky is because the science is unknown, you know, it's really hard to just dismiss out of hand their argument that it's better for people. And I think this is where public health advocates have found what seems like a really straightforward story to like get derailed easily by saying like, well, we're keeping people from, you know, a known carcinogen, a known cause of cancer. So, you know, we're just right now in this middle ground. And it's been interesting to see how Silicon Valley has responded to the company. There are definitely some investors who are interested in backing the company, but they have vice clauses with their limited partners that don't allow them to. So I think because of that, it's also created like a kind of a convenient line in the sand. You know, it's easy for everyone to distance themselves from the product, but I don't know. I think they are really also enamored with how quickly it grew in a way. You know, as a consumer product, you can kind of see the gleam in their eyes when they talk about it.
Natasha Tegu, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
One final quick break and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best things we've seen on the web this week.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, time for Don't Close My Tabs. Will, let's start with you. What did you enjoy reading this last week?
All right, this is a tab that I literally did have trouble closing, or at least I couldn't stop going back and reading it because there were multiple ways to interpret it. But it's a story in Huffington Post called Jack Dorsey Has No Clue What He Wants. And this is a Q&A that the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, he's also the CEO of Square, by the way, but this was more about his work with Twitter. He sat for this with Ashley Feinberg of HuffPost. If you know Ashley's work, she's hilarious and sort of a bomb thrower and enjoys kind of trolling public figures to provoke them into saying things, and then has also perfected the art of taking them down on Twitter, although she did once get taken down by Ted Cruz herself. That's another story. In this case, Dorsey agreed to an interview with her, which is a little surprising. He did it because she had been DMing him on Twitter saying things like, Jack, you could end all of this. Jack, delete the website. Jack, it's time. You need to shut down the website. Finally, he was like, look, let's sit down and talk about this. And the interview was so fascinating, not because of anything Dorsey said, but because of what he didn't say and what Feinberg, as a reporter, did with that. So in response to a lot of very specific questions from Feinberg, Dorsey did something that he wants to do, which is kind of revert to generalities and speak about the hard thought that the company is putting into problems like this and how, you know, we still haven't figured it all out. And that's something we're going to have to really examine.
It was amazing.
Right. He didn't say.
I'm so impressed at these executives who they've been trained to say nothing. It's incredible.
Right. And this is a very common thing. But what made this story interesting is that Feinberg, instead of just running the Q&A and being like, well, I guess I didn't get much out of Jack Dorsey, but here's what he said, she kind of flipped the genre on its head and started the story by saying, I sat down with Jack Dorsey and he didn't say anything. And she made it the whole piece about his refusal to get into specifics and about his gibberish, in her words. And so the story became the fact that he didn't say anything rather than just being another sort of bland Q&A with a corporate executive.
Yeah, I thought that she had a really smart top to the story. And then the Q&A was just worth reading if you're interested in how people in power learn to kind of, I don't know, punt questions and not really take criticism seriously and kind of envelope everything into this, you know, easy talk. I thought it was just kind of a fascinating kind of study in rhetoric of power. Like, I feel like I've read this before or seen this before. I'm still trying to think through it, but just in terms of the conversation and the nothingness of it and the power that he has to actually do something and yet saying so little was just really demeaning almost and like fascinating.
Yeah. And a lot of people took it that way and they were sort of infuriated by it. Other people saw it as evidence that he's just clueless and doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't think that's the case, though.
I think I have a slightly different perspective and maybe this is too generous, but everything I know about Jack Dorsey is that he's a conceptual person. You know, he kind of thinks big picture and he thinks in generalities, and he's also running two companies at once. So it may just be that he's not that steeped in the specifics of some of the questions that she was asking about. But it certainly didn't come out well for him. By the way, I've invited Jack to come on our show at some point. So,
okay.
So we'll see. If he's serious about taking on tough questions, we would love to have him and grill him here on If Then. But yeah, so that was my tab this week. April, what about yours?
Yeah, I have a story that I read today that was really jarring and important called Corporate America is Getting Ready to Monetize Climate Change. It's in Bloomberg. And it it is about, you know, this litany of major companies like Walt Disney World and Coca-Cola and Home Depot and Apple, and really how they're thinking through how climate change is going to affect their business and their bottom line. And it kind of goes through some of the like talking points and thinking kind of points that these companies have discussed and disclosed. And, you know, one being Home Depot thinks that hotter weather due to global warming is probably going to cause an uptick in sales for air conditioners.
That seems like a safe bet.
Yeah. Apple's looking at like hand crank phone charging. So then people will want to buy more iPhones because of the flashlight in it. You know, Coca-Cola is worried that they're going to run out of water to make Coke. You know, Visa warns that global warming could increase global pandemics. So, you know, they're really thinking, these companies are thinking about how they could monetize climate change, how this could be a boom for them in different ways, how this will kind of be something they can bank later. And I just, you know, I think it's just really striking to, it's a striking way and useful way to remember that companies don't really have a body, a kick or to kick, or a soul to damn in many ways, right? Like they are a group of people who are agree on one thing, and that is that they're trying to make as much money as possible, and they're going to be thinking in those terms and not in terms of, you know, extinction and the people who will inevitably suffer first from that. They're going to think of how they can monetize that. So super important piece. I recommend people read and keep in mind as we continue to navigate the effects of climate change. It's something that I feel a lot being here in California, as fire season is now a year-round event. And just, you know, people being displaced and we have a housing crisis here. And, you know, it's something that we're just going to continue to feel. And yeah, it's good to know or keep in mind that these companies could make a lot of money from it. So interesting.
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece, and I think it's great reporting. I'll play the like soulless corporate apologist for a second. I mean, it would be bad to me if these companies weren't thinking about how the world changes under climate change. And of course, you'd expect them to also be thinking about how does it affect the market for their products and what can they be doing to plan for it. But certainly there are also companies who...
Would it be bad for companies to instead say, hey, we're all humans and we care about other humans and, you know, let's think about how much money we have that we make and what we can do to, you know, help people who are going to be affected by these disasters. Not, I don't know. I mean, of course, they're going to be thinking about how they can make money, I guess. But I don't know if it's something that I would say it's, you know, that I would like just say, well, it's pretty good that they're doing this, actually. You know, I just don't think.
No, I'm not saying it's good necessarily. I'm just saying the fact that they're planning their businesses around a world in which climate change is happening is not surprising to me.
Yes,
and of course, some of them are trying to fight climate change in various ways, and others are not. Others are obviously fighting to avoid any kind of regulation that could help us mitigate climate change, and that should certainly be condemned. There are also companies whose entire businesses are built on the premise of climate change. You know, water desalination companies, especially ones who are selling snow to ski resorts. I mean, that's like to me a pretty clear case of climate profiteering. Other cases like Coke worrying about running out of water. I mean, that just seems like common sense. Like, yeah, Coke should be worried about running out of water because if something has to go, you'd like to think that the Coke would go first before the drinking water. But then again, the way our society works, that maybe that's not what would happen. Maybe people would die of thirst first before Coke ran out of water.
I'm glad that Bloomberg did this piece to kind of remind us that these conversations are happening at a very high level with very different interests involved. So, you know, good journalism and, you know, predictable conversations. And I think that actually does it for this week. We really appreciate you guys tuning in. You can get updates about what's coming up next or just about the podcast we recently did by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod.
Yeah, I'm trying to get better at actually sending out updates about what's coming up next. Yeah. I realize we say that every show, and then we don't always do it. But
just follow Will and I on Twitter, which we'll give you our handles in a second.
All right. You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hi.
Yeah, and I'm on Twitter. You can follow me if you want, but I'm kind of weird. I'm at April Laser, and Will is at Will or Remus.
And thanks again to our guest, Natasha Tiku. You can follow her at Natasha Tiku. That's NitashaTiku.
You should definitely follow Natasha. She's super
She's
smart.
Great.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone who's left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that. It's cool of you.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs.
Thanks to Alberto Hernandez for engineering here in lovely Berkeley, California.
Thanks to Nick Holmes at Occupy Studios in Newark, Delaware. And thanks also to Nick and Kyle for talking me through Juul a little bit before the show. I was like picking their brains about, like, you know, who is Juuling and what is it like and what do you think of somebody. So I appreciate their help with that. We will see you next week.
Bye, guys.